We have not picked up on an ELT signal, nor if we had any other voice communication or visual, nothing that would indicate where they are.
The frustrating search for a missing plane carrying Katmai National Park workers. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 23rd of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the rush to open the Taylor Highway before winter.
We have, you know, plenty of fuel right now, but we will need 50,000 gallons, you know, by October.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
The search continues at this hour for a missing float plane in Katmai National Park and Preserve. The single-engine De Havilland Beaver was carrying three National Park Service employees and its pilot. The plane was last seen on Saturday afternoon when it left Swick Shack Lagoon, headed for King Salmon. The missing employees are Mason McLeod and two brothers, Neil and Seth Spradlin. The pilot is Marco Aletto from King Salmon. The plane is operated by Branch River Air Service of King Salmon. John Quinley is the National Park Service spokesman.
We have had aircraft up since early this morning on the Katmai coast and since late morning in the more interior portion of the park. We are focusing on the route that we expected them to take, which is from Swick Shack Lagoon, which is faces Shelikof Strait around Cape Douglas to Kamishak Bay and then up one of those valleys, river valleys, towards the interior of Katmai and onto King Salmon.
Searchers are focused on the northeast part of the 4-million-acre national park, particularly on several river valleys that drain into Kamishak Bay. The plane may have flown low along one of the river drainages, according to officials. Deteriorating weather on Saturday forced the pilot of a second Branch River airplane to do just that. The second plane left Swick Shack 15 minutes after the lost plane did and made it to King Salmon. No emergency locator beacon has been received from the missing plane.
We have not picked up on an ELT signal. Normally, if those go off, we would be hearing a constant signal from that device. We have not been hearing that, nor if we had any other voice communication or visual, nothing that would indicate where they are.
10 aircraft, both fixed wing and helicopter, are working on the search today. Quinley says the searchers will stay out until dark. Agencies involved in the search are the National Park Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, Alaska State Troopers, U.S. Coast Guard, and Alaska Air National Guard. Branch River Air is also assisting. The search began on Saturday afternoon after the plane failed to show up in King Salmon. The state has some aggressive action planned to fix a rain-damaged portion of the Taylor Highway. The road's been mostly out of service due to two rounds of heavy rain earlier this summer, and as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, repairs continue as eastern Alaska communities that depend on the remote gravel highway try to get in supplies before winter.
The Department of Transportation has been leading convoys to get vehicles from Chicken to the Top of the World Highway Junction due to recent slides, washouts, and ongoing repair operations. DOT spokeswoman Meadow Bailey says the convoys will be halted to accommodate for major construction work.
And those closures are scheduled so that we'll be able to do some culvert installations. So the road will actually be torn up in multiple locations and won't be passable during that time.
Bailey says the state understands that'll be a problem, but that the idea is to get the road fixed more quickly. The prognosis for the next 60-mile stretch from the junction to Eagle remains sketchy. That section's been closed since mid-July, except for a couple of state convoys that got through earlier this month. While portions of the road are passable, Bailey says there are some serious problem spots, including a major slide at mile 117.
It's probably 700 feet wide where a hill slide has sloughed off, and our concern is that it's not done moving yet, that you know part of the hillside will still give away. And then there's an incredible amount of debris that will have to be pulled off of there.
Bailey says the state wants to get the road safely passable all the way to Eagle before freeze-up so that essential supplies like fuel can be trucked in before the road closes for the winter. Eagle Power Plant operator Dave Helmer says fuel will be a concern if the Taylor Highway doesn't reopen this fall.
We have, you know, plenty of fuel right now, but we will need 50,000 gallons, you know, by October to make it through the winter.
Helmer says the Taylor is also an important seasonal transportation link for locals to get medical care and bring in food and other supplies before the winter when the road is not maintained. Eagle resident Ann Millard says getting in feed for sled dogs is one of the problems.
To add the price of 70 cents a pound for shipping it in by air, it just becomes prohibitive. I mean, what do you do instead? There's no alternative.
Millard says she's been in touch with Senator Lisa Murkowski's office and that a river barge or military aircraft are being looked into as a freight option. The National Park Service, which has a base in Eagle, is offering free freight on any charter flights it has coming in. This summer's road closures have already killed tourism in the historic Yukon River community and at the gold mining outpost of Chicken. Chicken Gold Camp owner Mike Busby says even though the Taylor Highway has remained open on the Toke side to Chicken, the flow of tourists has slowed dramatically.
The tail end of July, first of August, is probably our peak week or two, and we lost basically all of our caravan traffic and bus traffic.
Busby says business has been down between 50% and 75%, and he's had to let some help go. He says the Taylor Highway deserves a major upgrade as the road has become increasingly important as an Alcan alternative. Whether the road opens before winter will have a lot to do with the weather. DOT's Bailey says another stint of rain could cause a new round of slides and washouts. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska is a huge state with large differences in the cost of living from region to region. A state economist recently took a look at all of the available data in Alaska. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
Neil Fried says it's a challenging endeavor to figure out the actual cost of living in Alaska because we all live differently.
And so it's kind of hard to compare how your average person in one community in Alaska lives like your average person another.
One of the biggest factors that can impact the cost of living for a particular area is the cost of food. That data point is tracked by the University of Alaska's Cooperative Extension Service, which published the results of its latest survey back in March. That survey found that the average cost of food at home for a week in Anchorage was $123, which is well below the $304 it would cost in King Salmon and the $251 it would cost in Bethel. Fried says those numbers can indicate how expensive it can be to feed a family in parts of rural Alaska.
When you look at those Kotzebue numbers or King Salmon numbers, you know, there's probably not another community in the country elsewhere in the nation where it's that high when we're looking at the price of food.
Fried says getting an accurate cost of food in much of Alaska is hampered by the unknowns about how much and what types of foodstuffs come from the widespread subsistence lifestyle in the state.
There are obviously constants there, but also how does sort of subsistence fit into sort of that whole equation? And that's a real tough one, and usually because of its difficulty, it's just excluded, but it is very real.
One of the largest things that can go into the cost of living in Alaska is the cost of housing. Some housing data is collected by the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. The latest data shows that a single-family home in Anchorage costs on average $317,000, which is well above the statewide average of $272,000. Fried says the housing bubble that burst last year and derailed the U.S. economy has been slower to impact Alaska.
When we look at affordability, and because of mortgage rates and because of the fact that the price of housing has not been increasing very much at all in the last couple of years, that it does appear when we look at wages relative to the cost of housing, you know, that being able to afford to buy a home, it seems like we're right now in a period of time where housing has become even more affordable than it's been in a very long time.
Another factor that should not be ignored when trying to figure out the actual cost of living in a community is the inflation rate. The article in the latest edition of Alaska Economic Trends notes that from the first half of 2009 through the first half of 2010, the inflation rate in Anchorage was 2.5%. Fried confirms that Anchorage is the only community in Alaska where inflation is actually tracked by the U.S. Department of Labor. He says the cost of living data that is available in Alaska can be used to make some comparisons to the lower 48 states, but he says that is also slightly skewed.
I would have to say in general, the cost of living in Alaska is higher than most other places in the country, especially if we looked at it from a broader statewide picture. But there are certainly many places elsewhere in the United States that are more expensive than certainly a lot of the urban communities in Alaska. And that's probably a big change from 20 or 30 years ago when we probably took the cake in the cost of living in most places in Alaska. That has narrowed.
Four times a year, the Council for Community and Economic Research publishes the results of a cost of living survey for over 300 cities that includes Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and Kodiak. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, students in Juneau get an intense introduction to police work.
Well, it's like I tell the kids, they're getting in 1 to 3 hours what could take a week or two to teach somebody in a real academy.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. What would you do with an extra $56 a week? Well, that's how much you're spending if you smoke one pack of cigarettes a day. At $8 a pack, that's $240 a month, $3,000 a year. Think about it, and think about quitting. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-888-842-7848. It's free, and it works. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
A King Salmon man who was accused of compiling a hit list of targets he believed were enemies of Islam was sentenced today to 8 years in prison. Paul Rockwood Jr. and his wife Nadia faced counts of lying to FBI agents when questioned about the list of 20 targets in May. They pleaded guilty to domestic terrorism charges last month, the first time such charges were brought in Alaska under the Patriot Act. The length of Rockwood's sentence was the maximum penalty for the crime. His 36-year-old wife, who holds dual citizenship in the U.S. and United Kingdom, was sentenced to 5 years probation. She'll be allowed to return to her native country and take care of the couple's 4-year-old child. Authorities said 35-year-old Paul Rockwood of King Salmon converted to Islam about a decade ago and followed the teachings of a cleric who supports acts of terrorism and espouses hatred for the United States. The alleged hit list included members of the military and media. A southeast Alaska hydropower plant is closer to completion. A $9 million Alaska Energy Authority grant is the final piece of the funding puzzle for the Prince of Wales Island Reynolds Creek project. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Heidelberg's Village Native Corporation has been trying to build the Reynolds Creek plant for years. It applied for construction permits, put up some of its own money, and won state and federal grants. But it was still far short of the $17 million needed to get the project going. Corporation President Alvin Edenshaw says the Energy Authority loan allows contractors to meet an October 24th permit deadline.
We're moving forward with our project. Things are really looking up for a project here, so as it is now, we're hoping to start up here soon.
The Reynolds Creek project will be built near Heidelberg, a 350-person community about 45 miles northwest of Ketchikan. It includes a 5-megawatt hydropower plant, transmission lines, a road, and associated facilities. It's expected to take about 2 years to complete. The plant will become part of Prince of Wales Island's electrical grid, operated by Alaska Power and Telephone Company. The grid already draws power from the 4.5-megawatt Black Bear Lake project and the 2-megawatt South Fork plant, which are supplemented by diesel generators. When completed, Reynolds Creek will help supply power to Heidelberg, Craig, Klawock, Thorne Bay, Kassan, and Hollis, with new lines to Naugatuck and Kaufman Cove.
It's an important project in that it will essentially eliminate or greatly reduce the need for diesel-powered generation for the foreseeable future.
Jim Strandberg is project manager for the Alaska Energy Authority. He says the 33-year, $9 million loan meets the agency's guidelines. It's been made to Haida Energy, a partnership involving the Haida Corporation and the Alaska Power and Telephone Company.
The way the project is structured, and indeed the way we structured the loan, we created a situation where the wholesale rates will be largely levelized, and thus there will be no increase in rates as this project is brought on.
Lawmakers representing Prince of Wales Island pushed for the loan. Haines House member Bill Thomas, whose district includes most of the island, says Reynolds Creek will help the area's economy.
It's like every place else runs out of water, and then, of course, it's growing down there, too. Now, they're just now running the intertide to northern Prince of Wales, too, so you're going up to Knockadee, so they're going to be needing more capacity.
This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
A top official in the Department of Agriculture was in Sitka Friday for a meeting on the Forest Service's plans to shift to young growth management and forest restoration. Undersecretary Harris Sherman spent 4 hours in the Sitka Tribe's community house asking questions and listening to various perspectives on the issue. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The meeting sent a clear message that the Department of Agriculture is in earnest about trying to develop an industry around second growth and stream and forest restoration. Undersecretary Sherman was flanked at the table by Alaska Regional Forester Beth Pendleton and State Rural Development Director Jim Nordland. The Sitka Tribe of Alaska had the first hour of the meeting to discuss subsistence and government-to-government relationship building. Then came a panel consisting of Marlene Campbell, Sitka's Government Relations Coordinator, Gary White, the Director of the Sitka Economic Development Association, and 10 members of the local and state environmental community. Marlene Campbell lamented the loss of jobs in the Sitka Ranger District. She said Sitka had never fully rebounded from the 1993 closure of the Alaska Pulp Corporation mill. CETA Director Gary White, however, said the framework meant new jobs around Sitka.
Forest restoration, we have an opportunity to get into that forest, thin those trees, and find a product for that. Now, we all realize that economics are a barrier to that, but if we can think creatively and try to figure out a way to make that economic or find some products that have a higher value that will make that thing run, then we need help figuring that out.
White also stressed the economic value of tourism, recreation, subsistence, and the importance of retaining the brain power of Sitka's 20-year-olds. Those 20-year-olds had a high profile at the meeting. Andrew Tomes, the executive director of the Sitka Conservation Society, seated 4 young staff or interns at the table, each of whom concentrated on a different facet of the transition, including obtaining capital, hydropower, stewardship, and salmon. Tomes expanded on the idea that Sitka was still on the rebound from the closure of the mill.
It's not Happyville. It's a struggling economy that is diversified but needs constant efforts to keep up that diversification and find new innovation and opportunities. We probably won't ever see the day again where there's one big solution to everything like we had in the pulp mill that creates a huge industry. Because of the global economy and because of global markets, it's going to be a lot of small business and a lot of innovation that keeps us moving forward.
Contractor Marcel LaPerrier represented small business on the panel. He proposed that rural development fund the construction of a new 3-5 preschool using young growth timber. RDA Director Jim Nordland said his organization invited this type of initiative.
In any community, the thing that really makes projects happen, the community grow, is the person who steps forward, takes the initiative, has the vision, wants to make something happen. That if you don't have that, nothing is really going to move forward.
Undersecretary Sherman took detailed notes throughout. The meeting was brisk, cordial, and largely unpublicized. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Federal Housing Administration's network of FHA-approved housing counseling agencies offers free expert advice to homeowners whose mortgages are at risk, underwater, or in need of refinancing. Visit hud.gov/Alaska for a counselor near you. This message sponsored by HUD.
An independent audit into financial matters during the final months of Mark Begich's tenure as Anchorage mayor revealed nothing leading to legal action. The Assembly held a Friday work session on the issue. KSKA's Len Anderson reports the primary use of the audit now could be to help the Assembly build safeguards against future information gaps.
The audit did fault the Begich's administration handling of the municipality's cost under the public employees' retirement system. It said the administration unrealistically overestimated the year-end amount of money the city would have available for the retirement system. The forensic audit also cited the Begich administration's failure to produce monthly financial reports for the Assembly before the budget preparation. City code requires such reports. But the audit also said the Assembly failed to demand the reports and thus shared the blame for the lack of information. That's a finding Assemblymember Bill Starr disagrees with. He says if he didn't ask for the specific reports, he did actively pursue the information.
I take offense to it personally. I mean, you heard me talk about the fact that the finding is that, you know, as an Assembly, we didn't demand, you know, I don't know how more heavy-handed I need to demand or how many more emails I need to write saying I got to have the information.
Current Assembly Chair Dick Traney was not on the body during the period examined in the audit. However, he has served over 10 years on the Assembly. He sees the audit as a call to change.
There is enough damning indictment there on both the administration and the Assembly. What the Assembly has to do is learn what they did wrong. They did not follow prudent financial management. And so we have to figure out how we change the culture within this body.
Assemblymember Debbie Osiander had a suggestion.
One of the points made in this audit was that the Assembly did not ask for required reports. It was on in code that we were supposed to get a report, but we didn't ask for them. Well, frankly, our code document is pretty darn huge, and it would be helpful to probably to give everybody a list of here's what to expect. Here's the reports that are required to be given to you. There's nothing in place like that now.
After the work session, Assemblymember Bill Starr said he's still not willing to dismiss the idea of legal action against the Begich administration, but he's not certain how to proceed. The municipal attorney, Dennis Wheeler, told Starr during the work session that any legal action would have to come through the state legal system, not the city's. And Assemblymember Paul Honeman, a former policeman, said that to do so, the municipality would have to present a multifaceted case, one stronger than was present in the audit. In a short written response issued last week, the office of now Senator Begich notes the audit found no violations of law. It adds the findings need to be viewed in the context that the city's budget decisions were made during extreme national economic conditions, unprecedented in the history of Anchorage. This is Len Anderson.
The Juneau Police Department has 50 new recruits, but they're a decade or more from joining the ranks. For the second summer in a row, JPD has hosted a junior police academy for 6th and 7th grade students. The 4-day program is designed to give young people a better understanding and appreciation of law enforcement. KTOO's Casey Kelly attended the final day session of the academy last week and has the story.
Everybody look at me real quick. Grab one of these.
Officer Blaine Hatch towers over 20 junior cadets in the Juneau Police Department's evidence lab, holding a fingerprint card high in the air.
This is excellent. You guys see the ridge detail on this on these fingerprints? That's exactly what we need.
Hatch is one of three school resource officers who Juneau schools call when they have an issue for law enforcement. He also helps with outreach and prevention programs such as DARE or Drug Abuse Resistance Education. He started the Junior Police Academy last year to give kids a better idea of the day-to-day work of police.
A lot of people have misconceptions. They don't really have a clue what we do or why we do what we do.
Hatch says the academy targets 6th and 7th graders because it's an age group that's able to understand a lot of the information thrown at them during the program. He says he tries to hit the highlights of what it takes to be a police officer.
Well, it's like I tell the kids, they're getting in 1 to 3 hours what could take a week or two to teach somebody at a real academy.
Fingerprinting is just one of the many activities during the four-day junior academy. Each day starts with about an hour of exercise, then a variety of classroom and field work. Cadets are issued a blue cap and t-shirt to wear as a uniform, as well as a notebook where they keep track of everything they do, including sketching out mock crime scenes.
Just like a police officer would, times, what they did, details, and whatever they feel is pertinent or important to put in there.
In the lot behind the Juneau Police Station, Cadet Paige Cassell makes a plaster cast of a footprint and writes about it in her notebook. Both her parents are police officers, but Cassell says she wants to be a teacher. Still, she says the camp is a lot of fun, especially the part where they get to watch a man get tased.
It was funny because they had the taser and they clipped, like, instead of, like, pointing it at them, they clipped little clips to the guy's shirt and then pressed the button and he shook all around and he sounded like a goat.
Another class favorite is firearm safety training. Cadets get an hour of class instruction provided by local members of the Civilian Marksmanship Program, then an hour of target practice with air guns and police-issue Glock replicas modified to shoot paintballs. Cadet J.T. Nell had never fired a gun before the training.
It's important to shoot downrange when there's nobody there, and it's best to have a case when you're flying or just at home so that nobody can steal it.
Hatch says the academy teaches kids about more than just police work.
We have radio people here that deal with our radios. We have accountants that work here. We have computer techs that work here, dispatchers, forensics, scientists kind of things, you name it. So there's different areas within law enforcement that's not exactly putting on a duty belt and going out working in a police car.
Hatch says several participants in this summer's academies were returnees from last year. Next year, he'll be handing the program over to Officer Jason Van Sickle, who plans 3 sessions in the summer of 2011. The cost for each student is $25. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Len Anderson in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Ed Schoenfeld and Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development. August 24th is primary election day. Polls are open 7 a.m. until 8 p.m. To find your polling place, go to www.elections.alaska.gov. And when you go vote, bring identification. If your name is not on the register, you may vote a question ballot. If you need language or other assistance while voting, you may ask the election board or bring a person of your choice to assist you. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.